Welcome to the Deep Dive, your shortcut to being well-informed. Today, we're asking a pretty fundamental question. What does the word hero actually mean to you? We tend to think of, you know, flawless figures, brave individuals, but what if a hero was also, well, undeniably dead?
That exact paradox is what we're diving into today. We're exploring the really unique world of ancient Greek hero cults. It's a distinctive feature of their religion where venerated dead mortals, people seen as more than human but less than a god, were actually believed to protect the living.
And right at the center of all this is Heracles, or Hercules as the Romans called him. He's not just a big-name hero, he's probably the most famous, but also, interestingly, the most atypical. He's this figure of just immense strength, but also profound tragedy and loaded with surprising contradictions. Mm. He really challenges our modern ideas of heroism.
Yeah, he really does. And to unpack him and the cults around figures like him, we've gathered, well, quite a stack of material academic articles, historical analyses, even dipped into a Reddit thread and looked at some modern retellings, too.
So our mission today is basically to understand why these hero cults were so important in ancient Greece, what made Heracles stand out so much, and maybe surprisingly, how his story still echoes today. It's all about that fascinating crossroads of mortality, divinity, and, well, cultural memory.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's really get into it. What did hero mean back then? Right. Because it wasn't like Superman.
No, definitely not. Originally, if you go back to Homeric Greek, a Hirsius was technically a mortal offspring of a human and a god, simple enough. But by the historical period, say the classical era, the meaning shifted significantly.
It shifted how?
It came to mean specifically a dead man, someone venerated, propitiated at their tomb or a special shrine. The belief was that their fame, or maybe an unusual death, gave them this kind of power from beneath you.
Coward helped the living.
Exactly, to support and protect them. They occupied this really interesting middle ground, definitely more than human, but absolutely less than a god, an intermediary.
That's fascinating. Where did this idea even come from, this veneration of the dead?
Well, one compelling theory looks back to the pre-literate Greeks, maybe around the 10th century BC. They were encountering these huge ruins and burial mounds, tumuli left over from the much earlier Bronze Age, the Mycenaean period.
Ah, so they see these giant ancient structures?
Exactly. Imposing sites that spoke of a vanished grand past they didn't really have records for. So naturally, story started. People began to, you know, individuate the persons they believed were buried there, giving names to these forgotten, impressive graves. It's a potential origin story for heroes.
So it kind of grew out of wondering about the past.
It seems likely. And what's also really interesting is how it evolved. It probably started as more localized clan-based ancestor worship. But as the polis, the city-state, developed, these cults became civic affairs. You didn't necessarily have to trace your lineage back to the hero to worship them anymore.
That's a big change. It suggests a different kind of religious practice compared to worshiping, say, Zeus on Mount Olympus. Mm-hmm. You mentioned their power came from beneath the earth. Can you expand on that? What were these Trithonic rituals like?
Right, Trithonic, that's the key term here. It means of the earth or underworld. Hero cults were fundamentally Trithonic, tied to the earth, unlike the Olympian gods who were associated with the sky. Their rituals resembled those for underworld deities like Hecate or Persephone, much more than Zeus or Apollo.
So darker, maybe? More solemn?
Often, yes. Think libations, liquid offerings poured directly onto the earth or into a pit, often during the darker hours. Sacrifices were different, too. For Olympians, you'd feast on the sacrificed animal. For heroes, the animal was typically offered as a holocaust, completely burnt with the worshippers not sharing in the meal. It was purely for the hero.
Very distinct. And you said their power was often local.
Mostly, yes. A hero's influence was strongest near their tomb or shrine, benefiting the local community or tribe. Heracles, as we'll see, became a major exception, a pan-Hellenic, widely worshipped figure. But for many heroes, it was very place-based. We see evidence emerging quite early, like 8th century BC.
Any specific example?
Sure. There's the Menelaion near Sparta, a shrine thought to be for Menelaus and Helen, or at Mycenae, evidence of a cult for Agamemnon and Cassandra. Even Odysseus might have had a cult site in Polis Bay on Ithaca.
Okay, and it wasn't just men, right? What about heroines?
Good point. While men are certainly more prominent in the sources, heroines absolutely existed. Often they were wives, mothers like Alcmene, Heracles' mother, or Semele, Dionysus' mother, or daughters of heroes. Think of Iphigenia, famously sacrificed.
How were they depicted? Were they seen as powerful in the same way?
Iconography and inscriptions show them depicted similarly to heroes receiving honors, but given the androcentric nature of Greek culture, they often appear in roles that are, let's say, related to male heroes, wives, mothers, sacrificial figures, sometimes seen as shadow figures, perhaps, or in service-oriented roles, but still venerated, still believed to have power.
So these cults took different forms too, right? Not just one standard type.
Definitely not. There was quite a variety. You had oikist cults, which honored the founder, Erchistes, of a colony, usually at their gravesite within the city. Brasidas at Amphipolis is a famous example.
Okay. Founder cults. What else?
Then cults to specific, named heroes from the big myths, the Iliad, the epic cycle. Oedipus had a cult site at Athens. Pelops was hugely important at Olympia. These often had really strong local connections.
Right.
There were also cults that popped up at much older Bronze Age tombs. People in the Iron Age were putting offerings into Mycenaean tombs, suggesting reverence for these unnamed ancestors, maybe seen as a Silver Age race.
Wow, connecting across centuries.
Yeah. And some heroes even developed oracular shrines where people could consult them for prophecy, like Amphiaraus. Physically, these sites could be anything from a simple altar or enclosure to those large tumuli, the burial mounds.
Like the ones at Marathon.
Exactly. The Marathon tumuli for the Athenian dead from 490 BC. These mounds are gestures of respect, connecting the dead to the earth. Some even had internal structures for cremation remains and offerings.
It sounds deeply spiritual, but you mentioned earlier they also had political uses.
Oh, absolutely. This wasn't just religion. It was often statecraft. Cities like Sparta were known for using hero shrines for, frankly, political propaganda and manipulation. It's telling that hero cults often appear far from where the hero supposedly lived or died. Their stories and relics were adopted, sometimes stolen, for political gain.
Stolen, like relics.
Yes. The Spartans, for instance, claimed their conquest of Arcadia was enabled by stealing the bones of Orestes, Agamemnon's son, guided by an oracle. Or think of Cleisthenes in Athens. Reforming the tribes, he consulted the oracle at Delphi to get a list of appropriate heroes to name the new administrative districts, the demes, after.
So these heroes were powerful tools for identity and legitimacy, but they weren't gods on Olympus.
No, that's a key distinction, especially compared to, say, later Roman emperor deification. Greek heroes weren't thought to ascend to Olympus. They remained powerful beneath the earth. And crucially, they weren't always benevolent. They could turn vicious if ignored or left unappeased.
Vicious how?
They could supposedly send plagues, pests, illness, lice, fever, and boils, as one source puts it. You had to keep them happy.
Okay, that sets the stage perfectly for Heracles.
Right.
He seems to break some of these rules. His name alone, Heracles, meaning glory of Hera, is just dripping with irony, given she tormented him his whole life. I think his birth name was Alcides.
That's right, Alcides. And yes, the irony is huge. He really is the ultimate paradox. He's often described simply as both hero and god. The Greeks called him Heros Theos.
A hero god. What did that mean in practice?
It meant he uniquely received both types of ritual we discussed. The chthonic libation, proper for a hero, and burnt sacrifice on an altar, like a god, sometimes even at the same festival. This dual nature is absolutely central to understanding him. He's the closest the Greeks got to a figure we might call a demigod.
And this duality caused some confusion even for ancient writers. You mentioned Homer.
Yeah, it's noticeable in the Odyssey. Odysseus goes to the underworld and encounters Heracles' eidolon, his shade or ghost. But then Homer adds this qualifier, almost an aside, saying that Heracles himself is actually up on Olympus, feasting with the gods. It suggests the idea of his full apotheosis, his becoming a god, wasn't maybe universally settled or consistently portrayed in the earliest layers of the myth. Ancient commentators definitely noticed the awkwardness there.
So what drove his story? You mentioned Hera's torment.
That's the major factor in nearly all his tragedies. Hera's unrelenting hatred, all because Zeus had an affair with Heracles' mortal mother, Alcmene.
And it started literally at birth.
Literally. When he was just an infant, maybe 8 months old, she sent two enormous snakes into his crib to kill him, and the baby Heracles just woke up and strangled them, one in each hand, apparently, as if they were toys.
Incredible image.
Isn't it? And she interfered even before his birth. She deliberately delayed his birth and sped up the birth of his cousin, Eurystheus, just so Eurystheus would fulfill the prophecy by Zeus and become High King instead of Heracles.
Wow, that's plotting on a cosmic scale. What about the Milky Way story?
Yeah, that's another wild one. The myth goes that Zeus tricked Hera into nursing the baby Heracles, but he suckled so powerfully it caused her pain and she pushed him away. Her milk sprayed across the night sky, creating the Milky Way, a celestial marker of her unwilling connection to him.
So he's clearly defined by immense strength right from the start. But he wasn't just about brute force, was he?
No, not at all. He was known for using his wits, too. Like when he wrestled the giant Antaeus, who drew strength from the earth, Heracles figured out he had to lift him off the ground to win. Or how he tricked Atlas into taking the burden of the sky back after getting the golden apples. He was also the patron protector of gymnasia and palaestrae, places of physical training.
And visually iconic, right? The lion skin and the club.
Absolutely. Those are his defining attributes. But his personality was just as complex as his parentage. He could be depicted as this almost playful figure, especially with children. But he was also extremely passionate and emotional, capable of incredible loyalty and great deeds for his friends, but also terrible vengeance on his enemies.
What about his darker side? The madness.
That's crucial, too. Sophocles portrays a kind of coldness in him at times. Euripides, in his play Heracles, attributes the madness where he kills his family directly to divine intervention. Hera sends Lyssa, the spirit of madness, to drive him insane. It wasn't seen as an internal psychological failing, but as an external divine force acting upon him, which is a very Greek way of looking at it. Seneca, later, in Roman times, would portray it more internally.
And his relationships were, well, complicated, too.
Extremely. He had four wives over his lifetime, Megara, Omphale, Deinera, and finally the goddess Hebe on Olympus, plus countless affairs. There's the story of him fathering 50 sons of Thespiades in one night with the 50 daughters of King Thespius.
50. But it wasn't just women, right? The sources mention male lovers, too.
Yes, quite explicitly. Ancient writers list countless male lovers. Figures like his nephew and companion Aeolus are very prominent. Hylas, whose disappearance during the Argonaut expedition devastates Heracles, Abderus, Alcaeus. Plutarch even mentions that male couples in Thebes would go to Aeolus' tomb to swear oaths of loyalty to each other.
That really challenges modern stereotypes of masculinity.
It absolutely does. For the ancient Greeks, Heracles' immense capacity for relationships, both male and female, seems to have been seen as part of his larger-than-life heroic virility, not something contradictory. It was part of his excess, his superhuman nature.
Okay, all this complexity, this tragedy and power, leads us inevitably to the 12 labors. Where did they come from?
They originated from his greatest tragedy. Driven mad by Hera, Heracles killed his first wife, Megara, and their children. Absolutely horrific. When he regained his sanity and realized what he'd done, he was devastated and sought purification.
So the labors were his penance.
Exactly. He went to the Oracle of Delphi, who, surprise, surprise, was heavily influenced by Hera, and the Oracle commanded him to serve his cousin, King Eurystheus, the one Hera made king, for 12 years. He had to complete whatever tasks Eurystheus set him. If he succeeded, he would be purified and, importantly, promised immortality.
So these weren't just random adventures, they had a deeper meaning.
Profoundly symbolic, yes. They're not just disconnected monster-slaying episodes. You can read the whole sequence as the story of the chthonic and mortal hero proving his might and elevating himself to the Olympian realm. It's a journey narrative.
How so? Conquering the chthonic to reach the Olympian.
Precisely. He has to overcome challenges representing the chthonic realm, things tied to the earth, death, wild nature, monstrous beings, even human fallibility to prove himself worthy of ascending to the Olympian realm, the sky, immortality, the company of the gods.
Let's look at a few. The first one, the Nemean lion.
Right. This wasn't just any lion. It was invulnerable to weapons, a child of Typhon, the greatest monster, and Echidna, and grandchild of Gaia, the earth goddess herself. It embodies the ideal of the chthonic monster, the raw, untamable power and fear of the unknown in the natural world.
And how does he beat it?
He has to use his strength and wits, eventually stunning it with his club and strangling it. He then wears its impenetrable hide. Interestingly, the setup for the labor involved sacrifice. If Heracles died, a local man was to sacrifice to him as a hero. If he won, the sacrifice went to Zeus. This framing positions him as potentially transcending the typical hero's fate right from the start.
Okay, then the Lernaean Hydra, another monster child of Typhon.
Yes, another chthonic nightmare. Multiple heads, and when you cut one off, two grow back. It breathes poison. Heracles needed help for this one. His nephew, Aeolus, cauterized the neck stumps with a torch after Heracles cut the heads off.
Ah, but didn't Eurystheus reject that labor?
He did, because Heracles had help. It didn't count towards the original 10 labors, apparently, so two more were added later to make 12.
What about capturing animals? like the Golden Hind or the Erymanthian Boar.
Those labors, numbers 3 and 4, involved capturing, not killing, sacred or dangerous animals. They represent a kind of mastery over the natural world to provide food and sustenance. With the hind, which was sacred to Artemis, he had to chase it for a year. Artemis was initially angry, but eventually gave her blessing of an immortal to his mortal task when he explained the situation.
And there were encounters with centaurs mixed in?
Yes. During the fourth labor, the boar hunt, and later the fifth, centaurs, being half human, half horse, perfectly symbolized that bridge or conflict between civilization and wilderness. His interactions with them, like the hospitable Pholus or the wise teacher Chiron, whom Heracles tragically wounds by accident with a poisoned arrow, highlight humanity's struggle with its own sort of feral, unsophisticated elements. He masters the wild, but respects figures like Chiron.
Then came the Augean stables.
Yeah.
That sounds less glamorous.
Definitely played as a humiliating task. Cleaning these enormous stables filled with immortal cattle dung in a single day. He did it cleverly by diverting two rivers, Alpheus and Peneus, to flush them out. But Eurystheus rejected this one, too.
Why this time?
Because Heracles had arranged to receive payment from King Augeas if he succeeded. So, again, it didn't count for Eurystheus. The list is growing.
So after these, the challenges seemed to escalate. Stymphalian birds, Cretan bull, mares of Diomedes.
Right. Labors 6, 7, and 8 involved defeating or taming really dangerous beasts. The mares of Diomedes were particularly nasty. They ate human flesh. Heracles tames them, but the stories often add a coda showing that these conquered forces, even once conquered, can again wreak havoc if they are unleashed within civilization.
How so?
Like the Cretan bull, after Heracles brought it back, it escaped and terrorized Marathon until Theseus killed it. The mares, interestingly, after being brought to Eurystheus, were dedicated to Hera, wandered off to Mount Olympus, and were apparently killed by wild animals there, suggesting the Olympian realm itself fears nothing from untamed nature.
The next couple, Hippolyta's Belt and the Cattle of Geryon, seem to move beyond just monsters.
They absolutely amplify the challenge. Labor 9, getting the belt of Hippolyta, queen of the Amazons, pits him against a human army. Things go wrong, partly due to Hera's interference. Labor 10, stealing the cattle of the three-bodied giant Geryon from the edge of the world, involves fighting Geryon, his herdsman, his two-headed dog, and even facing core elements of the natural world.
Like what?
He gets annoyed by the heat of the sun, crossing the desert, and actually shoots an arrow at Helios, the sun god. Helios, instead of being angry, is impressed and lends Heracles his golden cup or bowl to sail across the ocean. He also battles sea monsters sent by Poseidon. It shows his almost godlike superiority in military matters and how he's nearing total deification.
Okay, number 11. The golden apples of the Hesperides. This sounds mythical.
Deeply mythical. This is basically trespassing into Hera's sacred garden at the world's end, guarded by nymphs, the Hesperides, and an immortal dragon. Lead on. The apples grant immortality.
And he just walks in and takes them.
Not quite. In the most famous version, he doesn't take them himself. He encounters Atlas, who holds up the heavens. Heracles offers to hold the sky for Atlas if Atlas will get the apples for him. Atlas agrees, gets the apples, but then tries to trick Heracles into holding the sky forever.
Oh.
But Heracles uses his wits again. He pretends to agree, but asks Atlas to just take the sky back for a moment so he can adjust his cloak or put a pad on his shoulder. Atlas foolishly agrees, takes the sky back, and Heracles just picks up the apples and leaves.
Clever. What's the symbolism here?
By holding up the sky, even temporarily, he becomes symbolically at once of the earth and of the sky, literally bridging those realms. But he doesn't keep the apples. They're eventually returned to the garden, usually via Athena. He hasn't truly achieved immortality yet.
Which brings us to the final, 12th labor, Cerberus.
The ultimate challenge, going down into Hades, the underworld itself, to capture Cerberus, the monstrous three-headed hound who guards the entrance. This is the riskiest labor, confronting the greatest power in the Chthonic realm.
How does he manage it?
He gets help from Hermes and Athena to navigate the underworld. Hades allows him to take Cerberus, but only if he can overpower him without using weapons. So Heracles wrestles the beast into submission. By doing this, he proves that he, like the Olympian gods, is unaffected by this danger. Death holds no ultimate power over him.
It's the ultimate triumph over the Chthonic.
Exactly. This is the true divide between the Chthonic and the Olympian. Gods don't die. They aren't threatened by the underworld. Unlike other heroes who went to Hades, like Theseus, who got stuck there until Heracles rescued him, Heracles conquers it. It's his definitive statement of overcoming mortality itself.
So the labors are complete. He should achieve immortality now, right? But his end is still tragic.
It is. The path isn't quite straight. Years later, he marries his third wife, Gianera. There's an incident with a centaur, Nessus, who tries to abduct her. Heracles shoots Nessus with an arrow dipped in the Hydra's poisonous blood.
The Hydra's blood comes back.
It does. As Nessus is dying, he deceptively tells Deianira that his blood, mixed with semen, will act as a powerful love charm, ensuring Heracles' faithfulness if she ever needs it. He knows it's poison, of course.
Oh, no.
Years later, Deianira becomes jealous, fearing Heracles is interested in another woman, Iole. Remembering Nessus' gift, she smears the concoction onto a beautiful tunic and sends it to Heracles as a present.
And he puts it on?
He does. As soon as the tunic warms against his skin, the Hydra's poison activates. It burns him terribly, sticking to his flesh, tearing it away when he tries to remove it. The pain is unimaginable. Unbearable.
So even Heracles couldn't overcome this?
Not the physical agony. In his torment, realizing his end is near, he travels to Mount Oeta. There, he builds his own funeral pyre, climbs onto it, and asks his companion, Philoctetes, to light it. Philoctetes eventually agrees, often receiving Heracles' bow and arrows in return.
A self-immolation, but then something else happens.
Yes. At the very moment the pyre is lit and his mortal body begins to burn, a flaming thunderbolt crashes down from Zeus. It consumes his mortal part entirely. There are no bones, no physical remains left on the pyre. He awakens on Mount Olympus, fully divine, in the company of the gods. His apotheosis is complete.
And Hera, his lifelong enemy.
This is perhaps the most stunning part of the transformation. Hera, his tormentor, undergoes a complete shift. She reconciles with him. There's even a bizarre ritual described where she performs a symbolic rebirth of Heracles. She draws him close under her robes and then pushes him out through her clothes, effectively making herself his adoptive mother in godhood.
Wow. Full circle doesn't even begin to cover it.
Right. After this, he marries Hebe, the goddess of youth, who is actually Hera's daughter. They have two divine children, Alexiares and Anicetus, whose names mean things like warder off of evil and the unconquerable.
So this whole journey, the suffering, the labors, the horrific death, it all leads to this ultimate reconciliation and divinity. What did that mean to the Greeks?
It had profound spiritual significance. He was worshipped in that dual role we mentioned as Heros Theos. He embodied human striving and valor, the model hero, but also represented these almost uncontrollable divine forces. Crucially, he represents a reconciliation between mortal men and the eternal gods.
How does he reconcile them?
Because he lived as a human. He suffered. He made terrible mistakes like the infanticide. He endured Hera's relentless torment. These experiences bind him irrevocably to the human condition in a way no Olympian god born immortal could ever truly understand.
So his suffering makes him relatable, even as a god.
Exactly. Because he endured tragedy, overcame death itself, and then ascended to the heavens, he offered an unrivaled human perspective to the gods. He understood loss, pain, madness, toil, things immortals couldn't grasp experientially. This made him an incredibly powerful figure for worship, someone mortals could appeal to who might genuinely comprehend their plight.
You mentioned earlier he could be seen as a sort of proto-Christ figure in the ancient Greek context. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, it's a careful comparison, obviously, but there are parallels. You have a figure who is both human and divine Heros Theos, who suffers immensely, endures trials, descends into the underworld, harrowing of hell, anyone, overcomes death, and ascends to the heavens. He acts as an intermediary, someone who understands human suffering and can potentially intercede with the higher powers. For the Greeks, he offered a unique model of overcoming mortal limitations and bridging that gap to the divine.
That's a really powerful idea. And this figure, this hero god, is connected to the Olympics too.
Yes, fascinatingly. Myth credits Heracles with actually founding the Olympic Games. There are different versions of the story, but one common one has him establishing the games at Olympia in honor of his father Zeus after cleaning the Augean stables, or perhaps after conquering Elis.
Is there a linguistic link?
There is. The Greek word athalos is really interesting. It means both a hero's labor or contest, like Heracles' labors, and an athlete's competition. So the very word connects his divine trials to the human athletic contests held at Olympia.
And the location names themselves.
Exactly. You have Olympus, the mythical mountain home of the gods, the place of immortalization, and Olympia, the earthly site where mortal athletes strove for glory, maybe a form of symbolic immortalization through fame. It makes the hero's journey, Heracles' journey, feel very tangible and ritually reenacted.
His influence clearly spread far beyond Greece itself.
Oh, enormously. In Rome, as Hercules, he was incredibly popular. Emperors like Commodus and Maximian actually identified themselves with him, depicted themselves in his lion skin. His temples were widespread.
And outside the Greco-Roman world.
He synced up with other cultures too. In Egypt, he was sometimes associated with native gods like Shu, Khonsu, or the ram god Herishaf. There was even a major port city called Heracleion, now underwater.
Anywhere else?
His symbolism traveled east via Greco-Buddhist art. Some scholars see his influence in figures like Vajrapani, a protector deity often depicted muscular and sometimes holding a thunderbolt, which echoed Heracles' club. This might even connect to the neo-guardian figures you see at Buddhist temples in Japan. He was also identified with the Phoenician god Melkart. His reach was vast, linked to places like Monaco, from Heracles Monoikos, Heracles the Lone Dweller, and of course, the Pillars of Hercules at the Strait of Gibraltar.
It's amazing how enduring he is, but how do modern portrayals handle his complexities? Do they capture that ancient figure?
Often. Not really. Many modern takes, movies like the Disney Hercules comics, TV shows, tend to focus on a version of Heracles who fits comfortably into modern ideas of masculinity. He's often presented as primarily stern or angry, maybe a bit stoic, but they often lose that ancient playfulness, the emotional extremes, the complex relationship, especially the homoerotic aspects.
Simplifying him.
Yeah, often simplifying him to fit contemporary molds. But there are exceptions, really creative reinterpretations. One brilliant example is Anne Carson's novel in verse, Autobiography of Red. It's stunning. It retells the myth of Heracles' 10th labor stealing the cattle of Geryon, but completely flips the perspective. It's told from the point of view of Geryon, the monster.
How does that work?
Carson reimagines Geryon as a sensitive, winged red boy, and Heracles, she uses the Greek spelling, as his slightly older, charismatic, but ultimately cruel lover. Heracles enters Geryon's life, they have this intense relationship, and then Heracles abandons him, breaking his heart. The violence isn't the physical battle of the myth, it's the emotional violence of abandonment and betrayal.
That sounds incredible. Does it connect back to ancient ideas at all?
It actually does, in a way. Carson draws inspiration from fragments of the ancient Greek poet Stesichorus, who wrote a poem called The Geryonice. And Stesichorus himself seems to have been unusually sympathetic towards Geryon, shifting the perspective away from Heracles a bit. So Carson is tapping into an ancient tradition of reinterpreting the myth and playing with audience sympathy.
So it shows how these myths aren't static.
Exactly. They are always remade, their narratives and meanings shifting. That's how they stay alive, through these constant creative reinterpretations that speak to new audiences and new concerns.
What a journey. We've gone from these ancient burial mounds and conic rites all the way to modern poetry, tracking this idea of the hero cult and the ultimate hero god, Heracles. He truly seems to embody the contradictions, the aspirations, the whole complexity of ancient Greek civilization.
Absolutely. From those dark, earthy rituals to his blazing apotheosis on Olympus, his story just refuses easy answers. It challenges any simple definition of strength, heroism, or divinity.
And why does he still matter, do you think? Why should we care about this ancient, contradictory figure today?
I think his enduring appeal lies precisely in that profound complexity. He's capable of incredible good, founding cities, protecting the innocent, but also terrible violence, like the murder of his family. He experiences divine favor and relentless divine torment. He loves fiercely, both men and women, but can also abandon them heartbreakingly. He's just so human, despite his divinity.
So we see ourselves in his struggles.
I think so. He reminds us that heroism is rarely simple, rarely pure. Even in these ancient myths, these larger-than-life stories, we find these incredibly powerful reflections of our own human struggles with strength and weakness, love and loss, fate and free will.
So, thinking about Heracles' journey, what does it truly mean to transcend? Is it about conquering the external monsters, the lions and hydras out there in the world? Or is it maybe more about grappling with the internal ones, the rage, the grief, the madness, like Heracles constantly had to? And maybe we can ask ourselves, how do our own labors, the challenges we face today, shape who we consider heroes and what qualities we choose to celebrate in them?
That's definitely something to mull over.
It is. Plenty to think about until next time on the Deep Dive.